My governorship was only 20 months old, and it had been a season of incredible change, both in Alaska and in my own life. I had been elected governor of the state I loved, and in just the past year, we had kicked off the pipeline, overhauled ethics in state government, slashed state spending with my vetoes, saved for the future, and put money back into the hands of the people. Plus, we radically changed the way Alaskans would be secured in the future with the natural resources they own. On a personal level, we said hello to the new Palin son at one end of the childhood spectrum and clung in our hearts to the other Palin son, to whom we had to say, "See you soon." Then came more life-changing news. The month after Trigg was born, Bristol came to Todd and me and told us the shocking news that she was pregnant. Truthfully, I was devastated for my daughter. It wasn't the morality of the situation. What was done was done. It was that I saw her future change in an instant. Bristol knew what our reaction would be, and that's why she said giving us the news was tougher even than labor. It took a while to absorb it, too. We prayed about this next step in all our lives and began preparing to welcome this new child into a loving, extended family. Though things would not be easy for Bristol, we knew that with God, somehow we could draw good from this change. In Alaska, we view change a bit differently. For example, wildfires in the lower 48 are often treated as natural disasters. Up here, we often let them burn, knowing that from fire-blackened lands, new growth will spring. Often a searing burn opens dead ground to new light, and under the soil, long dormant seeds germinate, covering fields and blankets of a tall, bright pink flower called fireweed. Here in the Great Land, fireweed grows wild every year. We mark out our summers as its blossoms open from bottom to top, starting low on the stem around May and popping open higher and higher as the weeks pass until the last bloom on top turns to new seed. Month by month in the summer of 2008, from Bristol's news in May to Trigg's first smile to Track's readiness for Iraq to the awarding of the Aegea Energy Project in August, my life tracked the fireweed's fuchsia climb. By the time John McCain called me at the Alaska State Fair in August, the blooms had reached their peak, the sign that a new season was only a few weeks away. It was pitch black when we touched down in Arizona, the home state of Senator John McCain. Late on August 27, 2008, with the help of a McCain staffer, Davis White, my assistant and friend Chris Perry and I had managed to slip out of Anchorage on a private jet. It was no small feat, as the entire media world was on Veep watch, and we were attempting to duck out of a place where most everyone at our local airstrips knew us. But it seemed we'd pulled it off. In Arizona, we emerged from the plane into a warm, dry darkness, and a small knot of men whisked us into a tinted window Suburban. We drove to the private home of Bob Delgado, John's friend, and the CEO of Hensley & Company, Cindy McCain's beer distributorship. As the dark streets and green foothills of Flagstaff flashed by, I alternated between tapping out state business on my BlackBerry and marveling at the way doors sometimes open before us, doors that we have neither anticipated nor sought. Yet when God presents those doors, we think, yes, this is right, this fits. There had been rumors that John was considering me, along with many others, as his VP pick, and a nice guy named Adam Brickley had started a website trying to rally ordinary folks to draft me for the job. Several national reporters who interviewed me about Aegea that summer had dropped off-camera hints to that effect, but I was very busy with state business, and the whole VP thing was such a long shot that I hadn't even considered it a real possibility. I had met the McCains in February 2008 at the National Governors Association winter meeting in D.C. During a reception at the J.W. Marriott Hotel, Todd and I had spoken with the senator and Cindy, and the four of us really connected over our families, especially when the McCains talked about their sons, Jack, who was set to graduate from the Naval Academy in 2009, and Jimmy, who had been serving in Iraq. As Cindy and I talked, I was pleased to find that this elegant, beautiful woman was really a down-to-earth mom who was as crazy about her kids as every other mom. When the conversation turned to us watching our own son go off to war, Cindy said, "You're really going to be on your knees in prayer more than you'll ever expect." Senator McCain insisted we call him John. I had always admired the Republican senator for his independent spirit and his passion for keeping our homeland safe. I sincerely respected him. Both Todd and I found him a kind, respectful man, not at all worn down by either decades in Washington or, miraculously, by his 5.5 years as a POW in Vietnam. Instead, he seemed full of an inspiring inner joy. Later in the campaign, I would see this joy again and again. I'll never forget it. We'd be at these huge, potentially history-making events, and John would clap me on the shoulder, rub his hands together with a grin, and say, "Let's just go have fun." It seemed to me a perspective forged in the kind of fires that make even the pressure cooker of a presidential campaign seem quaint by comparison. As we rolled through the Arizona darkness, with Davis up front and Chris tapping on her BlackBerry beside me, I was excited to have another opportunity to meet with John. For some reason, when the call came at the state fair, it didn't come as a huge shock. Perhaps after the year I'd had, nothing could shock me. I certainly didn't think, "Well, of course this would happen," but neither did I think, "What an astonishing idea." It seemed more comfortable than that, like a natural progression. I'd known it was only a matter of time before others saw Alaska's potential to contribute to America's future. Now the time was right. After that cell phone chat at the fair, I took Piper on the next carnival ride as promised. Then I called Todd on the slope and Chris, and they both began working to make the Arizona meeting happen without alerting the press. It was a big deal to try to pull it off. Information security was a huge concern. By that time, just 5 days before the Republican National Convention, the Veep stakes ran end-to-end through daily news coverage. Bureau reporters had staked out the homes and offices of the major contenders, eyes peeled for the slightest clue. I remembered that during the Democrat Veep stakes, they'd even put surveillance on Joe Biden's mom. But Governor Sarah Palin of Alaska? That was too far out of the box. We did have our local reporters, though. Getting past them would be a trick. And how would we keep this a secret from my staff, especially if I got the nod and went straight to the convention in Minnesota? I was always at work. When I served as mayor, I had Piper on a Monday and was back at work on Tuesday, stopping by with her tucked in a car seat. When I had Trig, my staff brought me state paperwork to do, and I signed a bill into law from the hospital bed. I didn't miss much work for any reason. To my staff, it would be inexplicable that I wasn't in the office on an ordinary Thursday morning. In discussing logistics for getting me out of Alaska undetected, the McCain people delivered one piece of news with the potential to change the course of the entire campaign. If John picked me as his running mate, Todd would have to confiscate our 3 teenager cell phones without an explanation when they weren't even in trouble. This, of course, would be scarier than anything the Obama-Biden camp could throw at us. Now in Arizona, we pulled into the driveway of an imposing home surrounded by trees that soared into a star-spangled sky. When I stepped out of the car, I was again struck by a blast of warm nighttime air, the day's heat still baking up from the earth. Alaskans don't get to enjoy a warm, starry night, ever. If it's dark enough to see the stars, then it's quite cold. So the balmy air felt foreign and exotic. Moments later, Bob welcomed us into his beautiful home, where he'd laid out a generous spread. Davis made the introductions. First, Steve Schmidt, veteran campaign manager, an imposing, gruff-voiced guy who wore sunglasses atop his bald head in the middle of the night. Schmidt, a.k.a. the Bullet, told me he'd manage Arnold Schwarzenegger's gubernatorial campaign, handled press relations for Dick Cheney, and worked on George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign. I knew instantly that Schmidt was business to the bone. I respect that in a person, as I'm not one for a lot of chit-chat either, and we were very comfortable with each other right off the bat. As a public relations troubleshooter, Schmidt specialized in shaping public opinion. His peers later told me he has a laser-like ability to spot chinks in an opponent's armor. He is a guy who inspires loyalty. In spite of his steely exterior, people who work for him really want to please him. Next was McCain biographer and confidant Mark Salter. He was friendly and quieter than Schmidt. Still, I could tell he was soaking up every detail. I later learned that he had once taken a punch from an activist who was agitating outside John's Senate offices, then wrestled the man to the ground and kept him pinned until the cop showed up. I also learned he was one of the few people who could change John's mind. We all sat around a coffee table in Delgado's dimly lit living room, talking first about my position on the war in Iraq, my record on energy, and Alaska's economy. We discussed the makeup of my cabinet and staff, which included Republicans, Independents, and Democrats, and the fact that I subscribed to Lincoln's team of rivals approach. I was impressed with these guys. They were thorough. For example, they already knew that Bristol was pregnant, a development that I thought only loved ones were privy to at the time. "You have to be aware that nothing will stay secret during the campaign," Schmidt said. "That's okay," I said. "I have nothing to hide." I admitted, though, to the one skeleton I'd kept hidden in my closet for the past 22 years. It made me nervous and sick to my stomach, but I felt obligated to confess a D in a college course 22 years before. Schmidt didn't bat an eye, but instead switched back to the war in Iraq. He wanted to know whether I understood the origin of the conflict, the history of the Middle East, and how 13th and 14th century differences had evolved in today's murderous rivalry between the Sunni and the Shia. I knew the history of the conflict to the extent that most Americans did. We talked about my perspective. Then I added that it was also personal to me as commander-in-chief of our state's National Guard and as the mother of a son headed to Iraq. I was paying close attention to what was going on and keenly aware of the war's progress and the issues on the ground. It turned out that conflict in the Middle East was Schmidt's preferred issue, and he seemed very knowledgeable about the subject. It would later concern me that when the tanking economy began pushing the war out of the headlines, Schmidt was slow to turn the campaign ship into the wind. When I look back at that evening's interview, it seems clear that there was an assumption at the center of the McCain camp that the war would retain center stage, come hell or high water. In fact, Schmidt gave me books on the subject, plus stacks of videotapes and DVDs to review as we traveled from city to city so that I could review the war's history at 37,000 feet. As a vetting discussion entered its second, then third hour, Chris and I gravitated to our usual powwow spots on the floor, propping our backs against the couches and arranging our Blackberries and cell phones beside us like playing cards, as we did during informal staff meetings at my house. "What about Walt Monaghan?" Schmidt said. "The public safety commissioner I'd reassigned." I gave Schmidt the background on Walt, his budget problems and insubordination, his changing story. I also told him about the independent investigator on the case, a guy who had previously worked with both Monaghan and the Democrat lawmaker pushing the ginned up scandal. My replacing a cabinet member was legal, normal, and necessary and had nothing to do with a former brother-in-law, I said. "This is a non-issue." "Okay," Schmidt said. Then he changed gears, shifting the topic to social issues. He seemed impressed when I told him that people in my own family disagree on some issues, like abortion, but that we don't argue over it at the dinner table. I have one relative who expresses her pro-choice position articulately. My own pro-life opinion diverges from hers by 180 degrees, and we've had great civil discussions on the topic. It would later amaze my family and friends that the Obama-Biden camp and their media friends painted me as rigid and intolerant. It was assumed that I refused to hear alternative points of view and used topics like abortion and homosexual marriage as a political litmus test. I explained that I had never asked anyone, including the Democrats I appointed, what their position on abortion was, and I didn't discuss my opinion on homosexuality with cabinet members or judicial appointees either. Schmidt seemed surprised and pleased, even when I reiterated that I was solidly pro-life and hoped they would never try to temper my position on the issue. Then we talked about gay marriage. That's when I told them about Tilly, my junior high friend and college roommate who, after college, decided to openly live the lifestyle she chose with her partner. To me, she was still Tilly. I loved her dearly, loved the whole Ketchum family. I explained to Schmidt that I opposed homosexual marriage, but that didn't seem too controversial in the campaign since the Democrat candidate for president held the same position. Once in a while, the guys would take a break and I would go into another room to visit via telephone with the source of all the information the guys out front already had on me, Arthur B. Culverhaus, Jr. Culverhaus is the longtime chair of O'Melveny & Myers, an international law firm with 1,000 lawyers, some of whom seem to exist entirely to eat, breathe, and sleep information. The McCain campaign had hired Culvehouse, a former White House counsel to Ronald Reagan, to head up the VP search. The 60-year-old D.C. veteran had once served on the Counterintelligence Advisory Panel to the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. By the time his team of attorneys finished peppering me with questions, I decided that if a person had ever done a single dark and secret thing in their lives, Culvehouse's people would not only find out about it, but get eyewitnesses, photos, and blood samples. These guys knew stuff about me that I had long forgotten. They knew how I had voted on issues during my days on the city council. They reviewed copies of my tax returns. They had transcripts of sermons that visiting pastors had preached at a church I had not attended regularly since I was a teenager. And they were the ones who told Schmidt that Bristol was pregnant. I was impressed. I also thought, good, they know exactly what they're getting. The next morning, we drove to the McCain's ranch in Sedona. The rose-colored morning was perfect, warm and dry. A rugged gravel road unrolled across the dusty hills, and I looked out the Suburban's windows, wishing I could run the rest of the way. I just left the coolness of Alaska's lush vegetation, and here we wound through desert canyons with cathedrals of soaring red rock rising near forests of ponderosa pine. I craved stretching my legs on a long, hot run through what looked like the scene of an old Western movie. The McCain's ranch was upscale Southwestern, a small compound with a scattering of guest houses. They had partly raised their kids there, and you could tell that. The place had a lived-in feel rather than the aura of some perfectly groomed, untouched retreat. We parked near the main house. John, sharp as usual in a button-down shirt and creased slacks, was waiting on the porch and greeted me warmly. We walked down across the lawn to comfortable chairs, close to a creek that ran through the property near a line of trees and boulders. I couldn't take my eyes off the water, which seemed to flow red because of the famous Sedona Rock. Some kind of hawk wheeled overhead, and John pointed it out, naming the genus and species. The creek gurgled nearby. I could see tiny lights strung in the trees and fans to propel the cool creek air into the seating area. "How do you feel about running for vice president?" John asked me. "I'll do whatever I can to help our country," I said. We were both pretty excited, but he looked at me very seriously. "It would be tough on your family." "I know," I said. "I'm sure it is tough." Though I knew it wouldn't compare, I thought about how, in some ways, serving for years in local office had been even tougher than serving as governor. In local office, you're serving your friends and your neighbors. That means you receive a lot of input, a lot of criticism. As mayor, I had people calling me in the middle of the night to complain about the neighbor's dog barking and stopping by my house to tell me their property tax assessment was off by a few bucks. When I was governor, I heard a thousandfold more citizen concerns from people all across the state, but at least a lot of the complainants wrote letters instead of ringing up at all hours. "My kids have grown up with it," I said. "Working on the slope, Todd's always had an unconventional schedule. The family's always been flexible and adaptable, and that's not unusual in Alaska. It works for us." "What does Todd think about all this?" John asked me. "He's very supportive, John. He wants us and Alaska to do all we can to help. We're up to the challenge on this one." Todd knew how much our state and our family had to contribute to the campaign and, if we were successful, to the country. It went beyond common sense conservatism and traditional values to the fact that we are everyday Americans. We know what it's like to have to make payroll and to take care of employees. We know what it's like to be on a tight budget and wonder how we're going to pay for our own health care, let alone college tuition. We know what it's like to work union jobs, to be blue collar, white collar, to have our kids in public schools. We felt our very normalcy, our status as ordinary Americans, could be a much-needed fresh breeze blowing into Washington, D.C. As the sun crept higher, I became increasingly aware that I was dressed for the North, wearing one of the three practical black and tailor suits I always used to travel. Still, the desert air felt good as John began discussing his independence and how much he, too, was irritated with time wasted on games within the political world. We had that in common and agreed that not being beholden to anyone gave us strength and the freedom to do what was right. No political establishment had propelled me to where I was. In fact, I had reached the governor's office in direct opposition to the political establishment. I looked up to see Cindy walking down from the house to join us. She is one of the most striking women I have ever seen, and that day she reminded me of one of those perfect, elegant moms on a 1950s TV show. A sleeveless dress, a little sweater, not a hair out of place, so petite and pretty, with those intense blue eyes. I remember her clothes because I was there in my Let's Discuss the Issue suit while she breezed across the lawn like a walking summer day. Cindy is sometimes painted as an ice queen, but that couldn't be further from the truth. Yes, she can be guarded, but who can blame her? It's no wonder that people like Cindy, who are unfairly clobbered in the press with lies about them and their family, appear to say, "Forget it. I'm here to help, but I'm not going to offer myself up anymore." I've been there. After a while, some of the giddy gets knocked right out of you. In Cindy's case, the press had been pretty merciless over the years. Because of her upmarket elegance, she'd almost been ostracized from working-class people. But I loved her life story, which began with her dad starting out poor. He'd pulled himself up by his bootstraps and made a great life for his family. Cindy grew up wealthy, but with a heart for those in need. In the 1980s, she founded the American Voluntary Medical Team and has since led dozens of medical missions, providing emergency surgery and supplies to impoverished children in third world and war-torn countries. She even brought one of those children home to become part of her family. More power to her, I thought. When Cindy met us on the lawn at the ranch, she had just returned from the country of Georgia, which had been under military siege by the Russian army. She gave us an update on what she'd seen there, then she and John went for a quick stroll while I walked up to the deck of the main cabin to speak with Chris. Looking out across the lawn a few minutes later, I saw that Schmidt and Salter had joined John by the creek. The three men had their heads together and were deep in conversation. A few minutes after that, John walked up the lawn, climbed the steps, and offered me the job. The tunnel thundered with 10,000 voices, and the air inside felt electric. I stood behind John and Cindy as he waited for the cue to step on stage at the Irvin J. Nutter Center in Dayton, Ohio. It was August 29th, John's birthday, and we were pretty sure we'd pulled it off, managing under the unblinking eyes of thousands of news cameras to whisk me and then my family secretly from Wasilla, Alaska to this moment. I was so humbled and honored, so thankful, and so ready to get on the trail with the campaign. Now the crowd's roar poured backstage like a powerful locomotive. An electric guitar whined under the steady drum of thousands of stomping feet. I glanced at Todd beside me in a handsome blue suit, his ice blue eyes twinkling in the dark. I whispered to him, "You look sharp. Are you ready for this?" Four of our five kids crowded in just behind us. Bristol, 17, Willow, 14, Piper, 7, and four-month-old Trig, who cuddled sleepily as he was passed gently from sister to sister. I glanced down at Piper, who'd grown up with small crowds and campaign glitz, but in the grassroots fashion of Alaskan politics, nothing like this. She grinned up at me. There's always been something in her eyes that says she's ready to get it done, but she's determined to have fun doing it. My big girls took deep breaths, smiled, and felt the energy of an anxious country waiting to see what was next for John McCain. We passed a whisper between us. "Say a prayer." Glancing out through the end of the tunnel, I could see the crowd and flashes of red, white, and blue. John's blue and gold posters, emblazoned with his campaign message, "Country First," rippled in the stands. I was proud of the senator. He is so bold, so out of the box, I thought. He didn't go with a conventional, safer pick. John believed in change, the power of independent and committed individuals, the power of women. He thought it was time to shake things up. Cheers, whistles, foot stomping punched through the music, echoing through the hall as the crowd waited to see John. I thought back to the green room, where only a few minutes before we'd greeted the McCains. He'd clapped his hands and rubbed them together. "This is going to be fun," he said, eyes sparkling. "Let's have fun. You're going to do great." The kids were awestruck. They'd seen John on television before and knew a bit about his heroic story. "Are you excited?" John asked Willow. "Yeah, stoked," Willow said. John was stoked, too. And as he bounded up onto the stage, the noise in the tunnel became a deafening roar. "I'm very happy today to spend my birthday with you and to make an historic announcement in Dayton, a city built on hard, honest work of good people." Cheers and applause rolled through the arena in giant waves. Like the entire industrial Midwest, Dayton has contributed much to the prosperity and progress of America, John continued. And now in these tough, changing times, after all you've done for our country, you want your government to understand what you're going through, to stand on your side and fight for you. And that's what I intend to do. That's why I'm running for president, to fight for you, to make government stand on your side, not in your way. It was moving to hear this man, who had given so much for his country, offer himself up to serve it again. As the crowd quieted, John explained his search for a vice presidential candidate. I found someone with an outstanding reputation for standing up to special interests and entrenched bureaucracies. Someone who has fought against corruption and the failed policies of the past. Someone who stopped government from wasting taxpayers' money on things they don't want or need and put it back to work for the people. Someone who grew up in a decent, hard-working, middle-class family, whose father was an elementary school teacher and mother worked first as a lunch lady and later as a school secretary. As I listened, I thought, only in America, me, an ordinary woman from a town at the top of the world, standing next to this American hero who truly deserved to be the next president? This was a man who had not only survived more than 5 years of torture as a prisoner of war, but had led his fellow prisoners and even refused early release. I thought of Track and wished he could be here to see John, whom he admired. The person I'm about to introduce you to was a union member and is married to a union member and understands the problems, the hopes, and the values of working people. Knows what it's like to worry about mortgage payments and health care, the cost of gasoline and groceries. It was true, Todd and I had been single income and dual income with and without basic health care coverage, and it wasn't unusual to still clip coupons in our home because a month's worth of diapers and formula cost about as much as a truck payment. An outstanding high school point guard, a concerned citizen who became a member of the PTA, then a city council member, and then a mayor, and now a governor who beat the long odds to win a tough election on a message of reform and public integrity. It struck me as ironic that the Obama campaign had captured the theme of change. I'd always run on a platform of change, and I quickly wondered, how could I start interjecting that "we were change when change wasn't cool" theme? She stands up for what's right, and she doesn't let anyone tell her to sit down, John continued. She's fought oil companies and party bosses and do-nothing bureaucrats and anyone who put their interests before the interests of the people she swore an oath to serve. My friends and fellow Americans, I am very pleased and very privileged to introduce to you the next Vice President of the United States, Governor Sarah Palin of the great state of Alaska. That was amazing, not nerve-wracking, and even sort of funny to me because it meant John had a little explaining to do right off the bat. Who in the heck is she? I gave my speech, and it was an absolute blast. The kids had fun, and Piper waved to the world. And as my family left the stage, I whispered to my husband, "Happy anniversary, Todd. 20 years ago today. Who'd have thought?" From Ohio, we headed to Minnesota, the site of the 2008 Republican National Convention. Our first day there was a whirlwind. Campaign staff whisked me from the airport to the downtown Hilton and up to an enormous hotel suite with two bedrooms, one for the girls and one for Todd, Trigg, and me. Track would be there soon, so he and his cousins would stay down the hall. In the center of the room, when he first walked in, stood a huge dining conference table. On the left side of the main living area stood four racks packed end to end with clothes. Looking more closely, I could see that one rack was hung with young ladies' clothes, probably for Bristol and Willow. Another contained men's clothes. Then there was one rack devoted entirely to women's tops and jackets, and another to women's pants and skirts. At first glance, it appeared that the campaign already had all our sizes, as well as a good sense of my style, which involves a lot of straight skirts and solid colored blazers. Good, I thought, remembering that all I'd brought on my secret whirlwind trip from Alaska was an overnight bag. Somebody's going to hand me something to wear, I'll put it on, and that's that. Simple, one less thing to worry about. Eventually, people started shuttling into the suite for introductions. Policy people, communications people, logistics people, assistant people, assistant to the assistant people. They were like human flashcards, there and gone. I smiled and shook hands with each one, hoping I could remember them all. During the first couple of days, I would meet the major players on the VP staff. There was Tucker Eskew, a clean-cut Southern gentleman who spoke with a South Carolina drawl. Tucker, whose McCain campaign title was counselor, was part of the political team that torpedoed John McCain's 2000 primary campaign in South Carolina. I heard that McCain's people had hired him in the hope that he could do the same thing with Obama. Obama wasn't saying much in his speeches, but his oratorical skills were absolutely captivating. I remember the first time Todd and I heard the Illinois senator speak on TV during the run-up to the Democrat primary. Afterward, we looked at each other and said, "Wow, that was good." But even then, I feared his smooth style would obscure what he was actually saying. Other members of the campaign team included Tracy Schmidt and Chris Edwards. Tracy was a very smart woman who had served as press secretary at the RNC and had a gift for media messaging and for relating with reporters. Chris, a White House veteran, was so kind, polished, and impeccably dressed. I was also introduced to a married couple that was working for John, Mark and Nicole Wallace. I was told the couple met during the 2000 Florida recount when Mark was one of George W. Bush's attorneys and Nicole was communications director for the Bush campaign. Mark, who went on to work as a deputy with Bush's UN ambassador John Bolton, seemed to me half sunshine, half thundercloud. Always talking with his hands, he joked a lot to keep things light, but I would learn also that he had a hair-trigger temper and often reacted to problems with a brief explosion. "This is effed up. Fix it now," he'd say. Blonde and pretty, Nicole was outwardly very affectionate, with a charm that some women in politics lack. She also had a television quality about her, always on and speaking in sound bites. Also on the team were a pair of very brainy guys named Randy Schuneman and Steve Biegun, the men who would be helping with foreign policy briefings. Randy began with a smile. "I've been around John McCain for a long time, and he's known for making a lot of bold choices. This might be the boldest one yet." I laughed, glad he felt comfortable enough to joke with me. "I agree," I said. Randy explained he'd done John's foreign policy briefings when John ran for president in 2000. He had also worked as a national security advisor for Republican lawmakers and consulted with Pentagon officials on Iraq and other major conflicts. I liked Randy from the start. He then introduced his colleague, Steve Biegun. Steve had served as staff director for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and spent 3 years as the number three man on the Bush National Security Council. He had been there on September 11, 2001. Steve was an expert on Soviet and post-Soviet Russia and had lived in Moscow for a number of years. I liked him right off the bat, too, especially when I saw an 8x10 glossy of his wife and kids taped to the inside cover of his briefing binder. His boys were baseball players, he said, when I asked about them. "I hope you're not missing their games for this," I said. He was. Steve and Randy were good men, helpful and unpretentious. They reminded me that Obama didn't have foreign policy experience. As a governor, I had gained such experience as it related to Alaska's international commerce and energy issues, as well as our strategic national security position. Steve and Randy reminded me that after a decade and a half in public office, including serving as a city manager and governor, I had more administrative and executive experience than either Obama or Biden. We assumed it was the campaign press people's job to get that message out to the voters. Most of the folks in this group would be affectionately known as the B team because, with the exception of the Wallaces, they were all assigned to the VP half of the ticket. Most of the B team turned out to be unquestionably first string. Very early in the campaign, Schmidt walked into our suite, escorting a tan, kind of tired-looking guy in a suit. "Governor Palin, I'd like to introduce Andrew Smith," Schmidt said. "He'll be your campaign chief of staff." I stood up and offered my hand. "Hi, Andrew. It's great to meet you." "Tell the governor what you've done, Andrew," Schmidt said. "What I've done?" Smith said in a thick East Coast accent. Schmidt eyed Smith and made a kind of "go on, tell her" motion with his hands. "Yeah," Schmidt said. "You've worked on the New York Stock Exchange." Smith turned to me. "I've worked on the New York Stock Exchange." "Oh, okay," I said, smiling. "Well, it's great to have you aboard. Have you managed campaigns before?" Andrew swiveled his head between Schmidt and me. Finally, Schmidt answered for him, "No, he's a financial guy." It seemed odd that we were being put in the hands of a man who had never run a campaign before, but Andrew seemed like a nice guy, and it wasn't my call. I figured they were pros and knew what they were doing. It ended up being a learning experience for all of us. In the suite, a beautiful, helpful lady named Coral had set up a sewing machine to tailor the clothes the campaign supplied. Nicole had had a hand in hiring a team of New York stylists, one of whom had apparently worked for some big-name newscasters, including Katie Couric. When we had a few minutes and the stylist helped me take a closer look at the clothes, the price tags almost knocked my eyes out. I remember seeing one rather plain-looking blazer and thinking, that costs more than a semester at the University of Alaska. I also noticed that instead of a decent $7 pair of nylons, one fancy package's price tag read $70. I hated to break it to them, but I doubted I'd even wear them. It was still warm out, after all. The campaign had also purchased real pearls for the girls to wear on the night of my speech. After that big night, I made my daughters put them back in the store boxes and hand everything back to campaign staffers. We didn't need fancy jewelry. Not long after Todd and I married, we bought a $35 wedding band from a street vendor in Hawaii, and it still works. At one point, Willow asked a campaign staffer, "Who's paying for all this?" "Don't know," the staffer said, "but it's taken care of." After my parents arrived for the convention, campaign aides took Dad down to Neiman Marcus to browse $200 ties and $350 shoes. Ever the practical and frugal one, he too asked who was paying for it all and was told the same thing. It's taken care of. It's part of the convention. No one had a good answer either to a more general question. Why was the Palin family being made over for the 2 days of the convention anyway? With smiles on our faces, we asked, do we really look that bad? We felt like we were starring in an episode of What Not to Wear. I was told that Nicole had worked with the stylist at CBS. She also assured me that all candidates traveled with hair and makeup artists and eventually introduced me to Amy and Angela, the talented hair and makeup girls. I told them I was comfortable doing my own makeup, but I did look forward to someone else trying to do something with my hair, which I had worn in the same boring style forever. I later heard that people thought I wore my hair in an updo so that I could look chic. Nah, it just saves me a few minutes every morning to plop it on top of my head. I didn't see how I was going to get used to sitting still while someone primped me. I had 5 kids. I was used to doing the primping. Like any mom, that usually just meant making sure the kids were warmly dressed and relatively wrinkle-free, and then we were good to go. Throughout the campaign, though, Amy and Angela worked their magic, repeatedly rescuing my hair and mess of a face after too many days of fast food, snatched sleep, and stale indoor air. As a stylist buzzed around me like helpful bees, I began briefings and speechwriting sessions. I'm sure they got a bit annoyed with me. They wanted to turn me slowly in front of mirrors to make sure the clothes fit perfectly. But I had convention events to attend, as well as opportunities for once-in-a-lifetime meetings with various people and groups. Also, I wanted to study John's foreign policy positions with Randy and Steve. So, while being tailored to within a millimeter, I talked over my shoulder with them and other advisors. It was all very different from my inaugural ball in Alaska, when I had run out in the final 2 hours, literally, to buy a pair of shoes for the grand event. I felt all the fuss over clothes was a colossal waste of time, and I was usually ready to bolt during fittings, thinking, okay, yep, that's fine, gotta go. I wondered who had strategized this part of the campaign. I knew it wasn't John. Never before had I been involved in a campaign that placed such an emphasis on packaging. When I ran for office in Alaska, I'd written my own script, usually traveled by myself, and obviously had worn my own clothes. I presented myself as I was and told people what I believed in. Now I was in the hands of campaign professionals, and it was my first encounter with a unique way of thinking that characterizes this elite and highly specialized guild. In Alaska, we don't really have these kinds of people. They are a feature of national politics. Naturally enough, as the experts, they're used to being in charge. But no matter how expert any of them was, nothing had apparently prepared them for the unprecedented onslaught of rumors, lies, and innuendo that packaging would have on my candidacy. I also wasn't used to the beautiful hotels we enjoyed on the campaign trail. In Wasilla, we have the Best Western Inn on Lake Lucille. We've used it for years, for everything from town hall meetings to the Wasilla Warriors High School prom. It has a gorgeous view of the lake, backed by thick forested parklands and jagged peaks, and is only a few doors down from my home. But it's not what you would call fancy. As governor, when I traveled on state business, I made frugality a point, asking for only reasonably priced rooms. So it wasn't often that we had the whole high-end robe and slippers hotel treatment. The convention accommodations were different from the place we had stayed to hide out the night before I was announced as the VP candidate, which featured pink carpet and at least one huge cockroach, the first one Alaska-born Piper had ever seen. I especially wasn't used to over-the-top perks, such as the flat-screen TV inside the bathroom mirror, an innovation that drew cries of "way cool" from my girls. Cool was not what I thought, though, on the morning of September 1st. I was standing in the bathroom, brushing my teeth, enjoying the novelty of watching the news at the same time, when a crawl scrolled across the bottom of the screen. It said, "Breaking, Vice Presidential Candidate Governor Sarah Palin's teenage daughter, Bristol, is pregnant." I nearly gagged on my toothbrush. Oh, God, I thought, here we go. The news, of course, wasn't a surprise to our family and friends, and certainly it wasn't a surprise to the campaign, nor were we going to try to hide it, even assuming we could have. But we would have liked to have announced the news in our own way. I knew now we would be playing defense on an issue that I would rather have been out front on. It surprised me that the campaign, which had the information in the first place, had had no plans to raise it in a constructive way. After all, it is an issue that affects far too many American teenagers. I also recalled Barack Obama chastising a reporter in a nationally televised interview, insisting that his family was off limits, and the press obeyed him. They left his kids alone, as has generally been the tradition. I couldn't recall much scrutiny of any of the candidates' children, Biden's, McCain's, and I was glad for them, but nothing about the campaign would be like others. I walked out into the larger suite just as Maria, a shy young staffer assigned to the VP media team, entered the room. Headquarters, Maria told me, had elected to issue a statement in response to news reports about Bristol, in my name. She didn't know who had written it. Maria handed me a printout. It said, "Statement of Governor Sarah Palin on the pregnancy of her daughter, Bristol. We have been blessed with five wonderful children who we love with all our heart, and they mean everything to us. Our beautiful daughter, Bristol, came to us with news that as parents, we knew would make her grow up faster than we had ever planned. We're proud of Bristol's decision to have her baby, and even prouder to become grandparents." I was pretty shocked. "Bristol and the young man she will marry are going to..." I stopped reading. I looked up at Maria. No, I said, "that's certainly not the message we want to send." We were not giddy happy that our unwed teenage daughter was pregnant, as the press release suggested. Todd and I were proud of Bristol's selfless decision to have her baby and her determination to deal with difficult circumstances by taking responsibility for her actions. But in no way did I want to send the message that teenage pregnancy was something to endorse, much less glamorize. I got a pen and marked up the printout, drafting a more serious statement that balanced concern with a message of love for my strong but, truthfully, embarrassed daughter. I knew we had only one shot to get the right message out there concerning this life-changing event. Then I handed it back to Maria, who relayed it to headquarters. My cell phone rang. It was Bristol. "Mom, the whole world knows about this. It's bad enough that Wasilla knows, but now the whole world knows." "I know, honey. It's going to be okay. I'm really sorry," I told her. Bristol sounded heartbroken. "Why is this even news? I'm not running for anything. What do I have to do with this?" "You're right. You're right. This shouldn't be top news, and I'm sorry it is. We're going to get through this together, okay?" Silence on the other end, punctuated by deep breaths. "Bristol? Okay. I love you, honey. You're brave and you're strong, and it's going to be okay." "Thanks, Mom. I love you, too. But I hate this morning, and I feel like I'm going to throw up." I hung up the phone and turned to the television in the living room, just in time to see a news scroll across the bottom of the screen. "Governor Sarah Palin on teen daughter's pregnancy. We're proud of Bristol's decision to have her baby, and even prouder to become grandparents. What? Maria was just coming back into the room. I don't get it, I said. This is the statement I specifically said I did not want released. Maria stared at the screen and her mouth fell open. I gave headquarters your edits. They knew. The incident sent a clear message. Whoever headquarters was, they were firmly in charge. And if they weren't going to let me speak my heart and my mind, even about an intimate issue affecting my own family, what would they let me speak to? Perhaps it was just an honest mistake, and I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. But after a few similar incidents, I questioned Steve Schmidt about what headquarters would and would not allow me to say. Schmidt was a busy guy. He didn't have a lot of time to elaborate, no doubt. He replied coolly, "Just stick with the script." Most campaigns prepare press briefing guides on their candidates. Fat three-ring binders indexed to multiple categories, including a detailed bio, a history of accomplishments, policy positions, and copies of significant speeches and statements. The McCain campaign had evidently been very, very busy and had not had time to compile any press material that explained who I was and what my record represented. I was told later that the McCain communications team learned the name of John's vice presidential pick at the same time everybody else in the country did. And to make matters a bit more challenging, my family, friends, and political associates were under strict instructions not to talk to the media. So when the avalanche of press inquiries tumbled in, the national media folks had zero information. What they did report, patchy factoids cobbled together from the internet and a few left-wing Alaskan bloggers, was usually wrong. Immediately after the August 29th announcement, plane loads of national reporters and opposition researchers descended on Alaska. There was genuine reporting, but also extensive dirt digging, which included opposition researchers hopping from store to store in Wasilla, asking clerks, "Does Sarah Palin buy liquor here?" These black-suited, laptop-toting flatlanders weren't hard to spot. They'd never been to Alaska before and needed a field guide to the local political scene. With their editors back in New York and Washington screaming for copy to feed hourly news cycles, they took whatever they could get and weren't too careful about vetting their sources, who included a defeated former opponent, a maniacal blogger, the falafel lady, and the Wasilla town crank. These credible sources didn't help the media's credibility in the eyes of Alaskans who knew them. After news broke of Bristol's pregnancy, the media train jumped the truth track in record time. The tone some reporters and many bloggers seemed to want to set was one of hypocrisy. I was amazed at how many liberal pundits seemed floored by a pregnant teenager, as if overnight they'd all snuck out and had traditional values transplants. The talking heads began to parrot one line. If Sarah Palin can't control her own daughter, how can she serve as vice president? Some reporters insisted I favored abstinence-only sex education in public schools. And see, they said, it didn't even work for her own daughter. The media got that wrong, too. The only time I had commented on sex education was in an answer to a gubernatorial candidate question asking whether I supported abstinence education versus explicit sex education in public schools, what some call the slip a condom on a banana show-and-tell curriculum. Given the choice, I answered that I would support abstinence education over explicit sex ed. I never said I didn't support contraception. I did. I also explained about being a longtime subscriber to the philosophy of Feminists for Life, a group of pro-life feminists who do not oppose contraception. At about the same time as the pregnancy story broke, another bullcrap story entered the wider media bloodstream. Who is Trigg's real mom? Formerly reputable outlets like The Atlantic ran with the loony conspiracy theory that I was not Trigg's mother. Perhaps it was Bristol or Willow, they suggested. Even the Anchorage Daily News reporters, who knew better, couldn't get enough of the story. That, too, would have been almost funny had it not been damaging to McCain and a hassle for my doctor, who was continually harassed by reporters to repeat her response that, yes, indeed, I had given birth to Trigg. Even to this day, the Trigg truthers won't let go of their bizarre, through-the-looking-glass fantasy. Another one of these stories that surfaced early on was that I had been invited to visit Wasilla Assembly of God Church to speak to graduates of a missionary program. I asked the congregation to, quote, pray for our military men and women who are striving to do what is right. Also for this country, that our national leaders are sending U.S. soldiers out on a task that is from God. The Huffington Post ludicrously described this as, Palin painted the current war in Iraq as a messianic affair in which the United States could act out the will of the Lord. In reality, I was invoking Abraham Lincoln's admonition that we should pray that we are on God's side, not that he is on ours. These baseless and frankly insulting stories dominated the news for cycle after cycle after cycle. Tabloids and mainstream publications ran their ugly headlines until people couldn't tell truth from fiction. Back home in Wasilla, Bristol could barely stand to look at the television as commentators started suggesting that her pregnancy might change the outcome of the U.S. presidential election. My sister Molly was furious. It's outrageous, she told me. It's so unfair to put that on a 17-year-old girl. Why aren't they talking about presidential issues? What's going on in our country? The excitement at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis on the evening of September 3rd was overwhelming. The noise was deafening, 10 times what it had been in Ohio. As I mounted the stage to make my acceptance speech, I knew we'd have a great time that night. When it quieted enough so that I could speak, I began. I am honored to be considered for the nomination for Vice President of the United States. I accept the call to help our nominee for president to serve and defend America. I accept the challenge of a tough fight in this election against confident opponents at a crucial hour for our country. And I accept the privilege of serving with a man who has come through much harder missions and met far graver challenges and knows how tough fights are won, the next president of the United States, John S. McCain. I reminded Americans that it hadn't been so long ago that the polls and pundits had written John off. He had been all but out of the primary race, but I said, they overlooked the caliber of the man himself, the determination, resolve, and sheer guts of Senator John McCain. Our nominee for president is a true profile in courage, and people like that are hard to come by. I reminded America of John's military heroism, something he'd been reticent to talk about. Then I mentioned how proud I was of all our military men and women. The armed forces were a unifying and equalizing entity in America, and we had a son and a nephew following in the tradition of millions of military families. I'm just one of many moms who'll say an extra prayer each night for our sons and daughters going into harm's way, I said. When a wild round of applause for the U.S. military died down, I introduced Todd and the rest of our family, making special mention of Trig and all children with special needs who inspire a special love. I said, to the families of special needs children all across this country, I have a message. For years, you sought to make America a more welcoming place for your sons and daughters. I pledge to you that if we are elected, you will have a friend and an advocate in the White House. I wasn't too far into the speech when I realized technology had failed me. The upcoming lines of the speech were no longer appearing on the teleprompter. I knew the speech well enough that I didn't need it, which was a good thing, since the machine didn't sync up for the remainder of my time on stage. Long ago, I continued, a young farmer and haberdasher from Missouri followed an unlikely path to the vice presidency. A writer observed, "We grow good people in our small towns with honesty, sincerity, and dignity." I know just the kind of people that writer had in mind when he praised Harry Truman. I grew up with those people. They are the ones who do some of the hardest work in America, who grow our food, run our factories, and fight our wars. They love their country, in good times and bad, and they're always proud of America. Applause boomed, and a chant broke out. USA, USA, USA. I could feel the energy, electricity snapping in the air. Before I became governor of the great state of Alaska, I was mayor of my hometown. And since our opponents in this presidential election seem to look down on that experience, let me explain to them what the job involves. I guess a small-town mayor is sort of like a community organizer, except that you have actual responsibilities. Applause erupted again, a shout-out to independent-minded Americans who didn't look to government for all the answers. I was so proud at that moment because I knew that even though the other ticket had looked down on my small town mayor creds, the convention delegates clearly knew that national leaders are nurtured in the cradle of local service. A little later in the speech, I spotted a group of hockey jersey-clad delegates waving their banners and cheering. I pointed to them, ad-libbing since the teleprompter wasn't working right anyway. "I love those hockey moms," I said. They screamed and jumped as only hockey moms can. You know, they say, what is the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick. I wasn't nervous. By God's grace, I was having a ball, and that broken teleprompter was pretty liberating. Still, after the laughter died down, I got back on script. I discussed my record, fighting the oil company monopoly, working for energy independence, and my work on the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. Chants broke out in the crowd. Drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill. A bit later, I launched into a part of the speech that, since Barack Obama's election, has proved my speechwriter, Matthew Scully, prophetic. When the cloud of rhetoric has passed, when the roar of the crowd fades away, when the stadium lights go out and those styrofoam Greek columns are hauled back to some studio lot, what exactly is our opponent's plan? What does he actually seek to accomplish after he's done turning back the waters and healing the planet? The answer is to make government bigger, take more of your money, give you more orders from Washington, and to reduce the strength of America in a dangerous world. America needs more energy. Our opponent is against producing it. And let me be specific. The Democratic nominee for president supports plans to raise income taxes, raise payroll taxes, raise investment income taxes, raise the death tax, raise business taxes, and increase the tax burden on the American people by hundreds of billions of dollars. I was nearly finished, but now I was getting to the Tom Moe part. I stilled myself and began by talking about the journey of John McCain, an upright and honorable man, the kind of fellow whose name you will find on war memorials in small towns across this great country, only he was among those who came home. To the most powerful office on earth, he would bring the compassion that comes from having once been powerless, the wisdom that comes even to the captives by the grace of God. The crowd erupted again with cheers and applause for our candidate. The special confidence of those who have seen evil and have seen how evil is overcome. My throat tightened. Thankfully, I was able to pause as more applause thundered through the hall, honoring America's veterans. It gave me time to brace myself and plunge in, though my throat closed even tighter. A fellow prisoner of war, a man named Tom Moe of Lancaster, Ohio. Now the applause was deafening and extended, and there was a commotion right in front of me in the first row. A group of people were pointing to a handsome older man, alternately clapping and patting him on the back. The distinguished gentleman had tears in his eyes that I could barely see through my own. His friends were ecstatic, and I could make out what they were saying. "He's here! This is Tom Moe!" This brave man had suffered vicious torture at the hands of the North Vietnamese. Like John, he had been locked in tiny cells for 5 years with rats, bugs, excrement, brokenness, and constant pain. I knew it would be only by the grace of God that I would make it through the next part of our message, because words in a speech don't do our veterans justice. Tom Moe recalls looking through a pinhole in his cell door as Lieutenant Commander John McCain was led down the hallway by the guards day after day, I continued. And the story is told. When McCain shuffled back from the torturous interrogation, he would turn toward Moe's door, and he'd flash a grin and thumbs up as if to say, "We're going to pull through this." My fellow Americans, that is the kind of man America needs to see us through the next 4 years. Seeing Tom Moe standing there made our message about national greatness so real. This wasn't campaign hype. Here was an authentic American hero standing right in front of me. I had no idea he was going to be there. It was an honor to be in his presence. I'm not sure how the next lines flowed because I was so overwhelmed with American pride that the rest of the speech was a blur. I've never seen a replay of that night, but I remember that as soon as I wrapped up the speech, I looked around for Todd and the kids to join me on stage. They had argued over who would get to carry Trig. It was a good thing Piper lost the argument, and she had her hands free so she could pump her fist in the air and wave hello again to the world. Immediately after the speech, John surprised everyone by joining us on stage and embracing my family. I was so proud of them. The kids looked great, even in a bunch of borrowed clothes. The next night, John McCain accepted the nomination. My family and I walked with John's mom, the precious and resilient Mrs. Roberta McCain, to join him on stage. As I headed down the stairs toward the stage area, my high heel shoe fell off. Great, I thought, figuring the media caught my first stumble. But if they did, they didn't broadcast it around the world. Bless their hearts. As we hit the road, three of the campaign staffers I'd met during convention week would become friends. Jason Recker, a special assistant to President Bush, took leave from the White House and joined us a couple of days in. A dyed-in-the-wool New Englander from an Irish Catholic family, Jason, 29, had two choices while growing up in New Hampshire, sports or politics. He chose politics, but I didn't hold that against him. He had shined as a volunteer during the 2000 primary and become a permanent member of the Bush team at age 19. Jason was a calming presence on the trail and was very kind to our kids. Jeannie Etchert, one of the trip coordinators, was a beautiful, soft-spoken young lady from Minnesota. We wore the same size clothes, and as the weeks went on, she would keep loaning me her black theory pants that she'd bought 4 years earlier. I kept telling her to find a duplicate pair on the internet, and I would order them for her because I was wearing hers out. My daughters instantly loved Jeannie's sense of style and enjoyed hanging out with her and another of the assistants, Bexy Nobles. A quiet country gal from Texas, Bexy was tireless and great at anticipating what we'd need next on the trail. I don't think she ever slept. It was pretty comical the first time I met her. I walked into the Hilton suite, and there was this young woman I'd never seen before, kneeling on the floor packing my suitcase. She looked up and smiled. "Hi, my name is Bexy," she said in her Texas twang as she tucked in a stack of my t-shirts. "I'll be assisting you, and I'll be doing this from now on." "Hi," I said. "It's Betsy?" "No, but you can call me Betsy." She was that accommodating. Jason, Jeannie, and Bexy were there at one of our first campaign stops after the convention, a stop I'll never forget. It was at a rally in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The town was a slice of Americana, with its quaint town square and mom-and-pop stores, red, white, and blue bunting, moms and dads, kids in strollers, seniors, people of every color. I was astonished at the number of people who had come out. These people were there when they could have been somewhere else. They were there because they wanted to be involved. Maybe it seems kind of sentimentally patriotic, but the scene stirred in me a great appreciation for the American system of democracy that stretches all the way back to 1776. Regular people from all walks of life turning out peacefully to hear which candidates have the best ideas, then going on election day to the courthouse or a local school or a firehouse to cast a ballot. Simply beautiful. Afterward, in the rope line, I was moving through the crowd, shaking hands and signing posters and hats and shirts, when I suddenly came to a stop. Standing on the other side of the rope were a woman and two teenagers whom I could not miss. The kids had Down syndrome, a boy and a girl. "Hi, what's your name?" I said to the girl, smiling. The girl stammered for a minute and finally managed to say, "Sarah." "Sarah?" I said, "that's my name, too. It's great to meet you, and we have the same name. Isn't that amazing?" Then I turned to the boy, and my heart just melted. Trigg's face flashed into my mind, and I thought, this could be my son 15 years from now. By then, Trigg was going on 5 months old, and we were still learning the ropes of having a child with Down syndrome. We were so enjoying this little guy with his just-happy-to-be-here demeanor and his silly smiles, and watching him get stronger, chubbier, and more fun every day, just like any other baby. Still, we were curious about what was ahead. We were managing well with him as a baby, but what about a toddler, as a teenager? I reached across the rope and laid my hand against the boy's face. "Let me look at you," I said. "I want to get a good look at how beautiful my Trigg is going to grow up to be." That was a significant turning point for me personally. At that moment, I realized in awe that these precious ones are all brothers and sisters. Before Trigg was born, I didn't know what to expect, and we had a natural uncertainty about perceived imperfection. There on the rope line in Cedar Rapids, I realized that my trig is part of a large and very special community. And look how this mom was making it work with these two precious teenagers. Look how she cared so much to bring them out to a crowded, hectic, but fun rally and give them what might be a once-in-a-lifetime experience, a presidential campaign event in their own hometown. And I just knew there was no need to fear anymore. At this rowdy rally in Iowa, my world became a more peaceful place. Todd was right. Everything was going to be all right. As it turned out, the number of special needs kids and adults who began showing up at events along the trail was spectacular. It was one of the absolute best parts of the campaign. I heard from experienced staffers that organizers would typically need maybe a sign language interpreter and a handicapped area large enough to accommodate a few dozen wheelchairs. But it seemed that at all of our stops, the number of wheelchairs multiplied, as did the number of kids and adults with various challenges. At a rally in Fairfax, Virginia, I remember looking about and seeing scores of wheelchairs. In the middle of my speech, it started pouring rain. Within 5 minutes, I looked like a wet dog and my makeup was running off my face. I wanted to keep going and finish because I didn't want to disappoint all those people who had been waiting for hours to hear our ticket's message. Even more, I was inspired to see that not one of the people in wheelchairs made a move to leave. I thought, this is inspiration. On rope lines across the country, I remember making eye contact with special needs families and caretakers. This connection was a kind of mutual acknowledgement that said, yes, their lives are precious, they're worthy, and now we're going to let America know that there's no need to be afraid or hesitant. Instead, let's work together to make this world a more welcoming place for everyone with special needs. I remember another rally down in Pensacola, Florida. Up in the stands, I spotted a group of 15 kids with Down syndrome wearing shirts that said, "We love Trig" and "Trig in the White House." I thought, wow, how great that these precious people have someone associated with a national campaign that they can identify with. I asked an aide to see if someone could go get that group and bring them down so we could have our picture taken together. Down syndrome comes in a range of severities. Some people with Downs can live self-sufficient lives. Others may be totally dependent. They spend their lives knowing they are different from other people. So it blessed me in ways I can't even describe to be able to help bring them from the fringe into the bright spotlight that most often seems reserved only for the privileged. It was after meeting all these amazing people that Todd and I proudly displayed the bumper sticker a very cool group from Arizona sent us, which read, "My kid has more chromosomes than your kid."